we take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Simon.
And we're going to be starting a new series today. And we're going to be doing something a little bit different. You may know that there are, I think, just slightly over 50 billion Doctor Who podcasts out there. And arguably, minus one recently, but arguably, we are one too, because during Doctor Who season, of course, we talk about Doctor Who. Everybody's doing all the other stuff, so we thought we'd take something unique and different, and I'm probably has been relatively lessly reviewed. And that is that Simon and I are going to take a look over the next few episodes at animated Doctor Who. Now, that's specifically officially produced BBC animations, whether that's for the web, whether it was for TV, whether it was for DVD extras, or whether it's the recreated episodes that have been released on the BBC DVD line. So we're going to start those, and we're going to do them in chronological order of their production. So tonight, we are looking at the very first BBC animated Doctor Who story, Death Comes to Time, which I don't remember what year that was made in. Do you know
2001.
2001, so post-movie.
I think it may have... It may have run through to 2002 because it was released in on the web in installments.
Around
2001 through 2002 in the second wilderness.
The second wilderness, okay. And it does in fact feature Sylvester McCoy as the seventh Doctor, so thereby ignoring the TV movie at this stage of the game.
Indeed, and it's one of those things that. It's easy to forget that in those wilderness days...
You could just stop that. It's easy to forget.
No, Death Comes to Time is I hadn't got to that yet. but the fact that the TV movie was seen by some as not being true Doctor Who, if you like. The show Doctor Who had run from 63 through to 89 and had stopped. And the TV movie was seen as one of a number of efforts to revive it, of which I think, abortive starts, I guess, because the TV movie was intended as a pilot. Death Comes to Time, it was hoped, would kind of signal a new wave of web-based Doctor Who, which it sort of did in a way, probably not the way that was envisaged.
Funny way to do it.
But it as you say, ignores the TV movie, and later on, I mean, the animations, the kind of 11 official animations that we've got are a strange mixture, because some of them are the reconstructions of actual episodes where the video has been lost, but all the audio is the original actors from the 60s, to the kind of extreme other end where you've got episodes that have a completely divergent continuity because they decided, hey, you know, this is Doctor Who now, and we're going to regenerate the Doctor. So in that sense, this wilderness was part of the bigger wilderness, because until the show came back to TV in 2005 and more or less firmly established that the TV movie was actually part of the greater continuity, it didn't kind of have that status, I think it's fair to say.
Mm. Well, just as, and I'm not going to give a long synopsis on this 50-hour program, or is it like 5 hours long? Three-ish,
yeah, probably
four?
About half that.
It's long. It follows three entirely separate threads that just sort of come together briefly at the end. One is Ace, played by Sophie Aldred, has been captured and is on some sort of prison ship. She is rescued by a Time Lord, and she is taken somewhere. And
learns to become a Jedi.
Yes, she does the Time Lord Jedi training thing. In a second thread, the Minister of Chance, another Time Lord portrayed by Stephen Fry, looking remarkably like Stephen Fry in a Edwardian outfit, is helping a planet overthrow the evil dictator Tanis. And this is sort of at the Doctor's behest. The Doctor was there to help, but then the Doctor had to go solve another crime, and so the Minister of Chance came in to take care of this intervention. And the third thread is Sylvester McCoy's Doctor trying to solve the mystery of some dead Time Lords who were on Earth, which also leads him to the evil dictator Tanis. And, well, I think we can't avoid this. The story really puts on some new continuity of Time Lords. They have powers heretofore completely unimaginable, that they can bend reality with their very thoughts, but they must never, ever do that, because when you start bending reality, it's all over. And this is a story of temptation and bending reality, and in the end, there are no Time Lords left standing. Not real ones, anyway. Including the Doctor. Gone forever from the universe. So if this was the start of a new web series of Doctor Who, it's a funny way to start by killing the Doctor off at the end.
Yeah. I mean, it's a mystery. It's a cliffhanger, isn't it? The show is still Doctor Who, and although it's clear that Ace is kind of being set up in a way, I mean, it's funny because you've described the three threads that run through this. The Doctor's thread, in a sense, you could see it as coming to an end. I think it's a cliffhanger, but it does kind of draw it to a conclusion. Ace is clearly being set up as this new kick-ass Time Lord Jedi force in the universe who could go on to become the main character in the series. But it's actually the third thread where you have the Minister of Chance, where it actually did spawn a series, albeit over a decade later, because the Minister of Chance went on to become a podcast series. And I think they're currently trying to make a film of it.
With Stephen Fry?
It's actually with Julian Wadham, so he's regenerated. It's not official BBC, so they can't use Time Lords, though they can't refer to Time Lords and such like. And it does have Sylvester McCoy in it and Paul McGann and a hell of a lot of other really big names. McCoy and McGann aren't playing the Doctor, they're playing completely new characters. But in a way, there's something in common with Death Comes to Time, which it has huge, huge acting talent in it.
Well, there were an awful lot of people in this that I sort of recognized their names in Death Comes to Time. But, I mean, if it isn't clear, I really struggle to get through this. I did not enjoy it at pretty much any level. If this had been the first Doctor Who I'd ever seen, there wouldn't be any more. And that's saying a lot. I think I had to come back and watch another episode of Doctor Who after Love and Monsters, or even Delta and the Bannermen, but not after this. And it's not just because the animation is, it's very charitable to call it animation. We are talking very primitive web animation. It's basically still photos that have been... someone's got on a rostrum. Yeah, drawings. Yeah, no, not photos, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are some problems with this story, which I'll come back to my opinion on it, but which I think arise from the technical limitations. One of them is that notwithstanding what you think or I think about the story itself, the pacing is really odd, and it does make it hard to kind of watch it. And it's odd for a reason, which is there are five episodes of, roughly speaking, between 25 and 40 minutes each. But within those episodes, there are chunks that were originally webcast when it first went out. So they would be sort of 3 to 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And this is 2001. You know, this is pre-YouTube and the rest of it. In those days, we were all on dial-up. Well, I was anyway. And, you know, you were lucky to kind of get through 3 minutes of video, frankly. Audio itself would have been a tough bet. So it's chunked up for that reason. And the video itself can't be fast-moving,
right,
high-resolution, whatever, because it just wouldn't have got out there in those days.
We could compare this to very, very early movies, pre-talkies, obviously. You know, the technology has, it's a new form of storytelling, it's mm-hmm. a new medium, the rules are not the same, you have to find your feet. I don't feel that they did find their feet, and here's a couple of things. I tried this both ways, because the animation wasn't doing anything for me. I just sort of closed my eyes and listened to it as if it was a radio play. And it's not good as a radio play either. So it is kind of, the images don't really enhance it, but at the same time, it's clearly written, it isn't written as if you aren't watching anything. It's the best way I can describe it. It's like, if they had made a complete radio play out of it and then animated it, I think it might have been a little bit better. But there are times when you just switch scenes and there is no audio clue whatsoever that you've switched scenes, except suddenly Ace is talking. And if it weren't for the fact that you see the scene of the Jedi training planet, you would not know. And I mean, almost in mid-sentence it swaps sometimes, where the doctor will say, "Well, Antimony, well, I'm going to do this," and then Ace goes, "So why are we doing that?" You go, "What? They're not. She's not."
Oh my God! Your impressions are uncanny.
They are. I know.
According to Wikipedia, I didn't know this before. It was originally pitched to Radio 4. So the thing about it being an audio play isn't that far off the mark. Now, I agree. I mean, it got released on CD mm-hmm. as audio. I don't know if it was in 2001 or probably a few years later. But then it may have been re-edited somewhat to make it work a bit better on audio. But by this point, so 2001, Doctor Who, during the first Wilderness, Doctor Who went onto the radio with John Pertwee,
mm-hmm.
it's Doctor, Paradise of Death and the Ghosts of Endspace. So it's been on the radio at this point. Of course, there was slip back during the actual run with the Sixth Doctor and an LP of the Pescatons with Tom Baker.
Mm-hmm.
And by 2001... Big Finish have been knocking out radio. Well, you bought it on tape. Didn't get broadcast, but Doctor Who stories featuring Davison and Baker 2, Colin Baker and McCoy
yeah.
For a couple of years. So what we've got here is actually a kind of weird that. The audio side of things became a kind of spin-off strand in itself. And during the Wilderness years, Doctor Who thrived in the other media, I think it's fair to say, because it didn't have anywhere else to go. So there's the comics, there's the books, the novels. And this kind of brings together the comics. So Lee Sullivan had drawn, I think, for Doctor Who comics, by which I mean the sort of panel...
Right.
You know, things static, and this is audio. So in a way, it's not a million miles from the kind of radio versions. But I think you're right to say it doesn't quite work as audio in its own right, probably because of those kind of technical things and the fact that it is intended to be seen as a visual Doctor Who.
Yeah, it just was odd. And, you know, now that you mentioned that Big Finish had been running at that time, I find this... I mean, I know the BBC, in a way, grant the license to Big Finish and then don't care, because that seems to be the way the BBC is. But to come out with a program that... And I still maintain that the Doctor was supposed to be dead at the end of this. Or maybe dead is the wrong word. Maybe Obi-Wan Kenobi'd, moved on to a higher plane of existence, you know, to get the Time Lords out of the universe. But gone from our plane of existence. And, yeah, if Big Finish is off there at a license doing Sylvester McCoy stories with Sylvester McCoy, that's just a strange thing to do.
Well, Big Finish are doing... They're filling in the gaps. They've got Davison and Colin Baker as well. So they're filling in the gaps. And so you've also, in the novel range, you've got the kind of missing Doctor adventures as separate from the new adventures, which are the ones featuring McCoy and which kind of represent the official continuation of the show. But this is the BBC kind of bringing it back as a visual thing, except of course it's not on TV. It's a different department of the BBC. They're doing web stories. Does it count? It probably doesn't when you consider the fact that the return of the show in 2005 has brought the TV movie into the fold. Death Comes to Time and all of the kind of weird new aspects of continuity that it introduced has just been quietly forgotten, and the mystery of the death of the Doctor has never been resolved. So
now I was kind of surprised when we went through this, because I mean, I got it very early that they were training Ace to be a new generation of Time Lords, and I had heard that somewhere before, that was in continuity in something. The books or planned or some nonsense like that by some, frankly, idiot who came up with that idea?
Andrew Cartmell.
It's
something from the original Cartmell master plan. So it would have been season 27. And perhaps for that reason, it is a common thread across those other spin-off media. So the books feature this idea. You've now got it in this BBC animation. It's also something that happens in the Big Finish series. Possibly they don't all quite agree on how it happens. I haven't read the book, so you know, I don't know. But it's certainly a common idea, yeah.
So let's just, and I'm not trying to pick on Ace at all, a little bit maybe, but obviously Ace is frequently held up as, oh no, Rose is not the first modern useful companion. Ace is, she's the prototype for Rose. Maybe I go along with that. But of all the companions the Doctor had, Ace was not the best. She was an obnoxious kid, but she was much better than obnoxious kid Adric, and she certainly was useful with explosives, but certainly not, frankly, where I would go with Time Lord potential. Of all the people he's traveled through, that would not be the one. It's like, you know, I've been traveling a long time, and I think Ace is the one that I'm going to teach to be a Time Lord. It just doesn't make any sense. She's too dangerous.
Well, I think there are two questions here. Is Ace the best companion? If you say no, sir, I shall have to ask you to step outside.
Do you think Ace is the best companion? Of all the companions,
she's close to being my favorite. Yeah, yeah.
It is very hard to divorce her from the worst batch of stories that the series has seen.
Yeah, but you see, I like McCoy. I like the Seventh Doctor stuff, and in particular the second and third McCoy seasons, which are the Ace seasons. So that whole dynamic, and that may partly explain, you know, where I'm coming from with regard to this story. But I do kind of agree. I don't see the point of taking Ace in that direction. It doesn't.
She's not bad.
It's not what's interesting about her character.
I'm not trying to say she's a bad companion. She is a very.
I should.
You know, the companions are. Some companions are more useful to the Doctor than others, and Ace was certainly useful to particularly in the earlier episodes, to Sylvester McCoy because he was completely and utterly worthlessly clueless, and she could get things done. As it moved on into the age where he was actually, he's not as incompetent as you think. He's actually a manipulating, scheming monster. Then she's a pawn in his game, and that's kind of weird too.
I'm not sure that the McCoy transition was actually that smooth. I think Dragonfire is the only one where he's a bit clueless, and I mean, well, he's completely clueless. Hey, look, here's a little huge, great, big drop. I think I'll just climb over this railing
for no apparent reason. Yeah.
And that's the only one from the kind of useless Seventh Doctor season that has Ace in it. After that, you have the dynamic of the scheming Doctor, and maybe she's being used, but only because everyone's being used by the Seventh Doctor. The point about Ace is there is some interesting character development that goes on with her, and they may have intended to once or twice with previous companions to do some kind of development, but by the second serial with them, they kind of forget about it. Whereas with Ace, they actually did it and they actually delivered. And so I can see that this is captured imagination for those people who are kind of shaping the various spin-off media stories, and they want to take it further and they want to develop her in some way, and so they turn her into this kind of Dalek soldier or into a kind of proto Time Lord or whatever. And I'm not sure those things quite work for me, but maybe I understand why they did it.
Ace is certainly the companion that has the most room to mature, I think.
Yeah.
You know, the other kid characters that we had along, Susan, Vicky, Dodo, really didn't. Adric had nowhere to go. And, well, Adric had a lot of places he could have gone, but I think it wouldn't have come off as natural. He was just so naturally entrenched as awful that it wasn't going to go. But the others really were good kids, and they were, growing up on the straight and narrow, and we would never buy that they would blow something up or burn down a house. Or so by taking a troubled kid in, which Ace was, we have room to turn her around and reform her. So in that respect, it's a good choice. I don't think then it's like, all right, well, I'll get her good enough and then I'll jump her up to a Time Lord. it just doesn't follow to me. But anyway, that's what they did in this.
Not the best aspect of the story.
No, let's talk about that one first, because I think it's the worst aspect of the story. It's absolute dreck. All of the babbling that Kasmus is going on about the outside the universe, not the left, not the right, not the this, not the that, walk over the stalagmites, it really was almost at the level of metaphysical bibble babble. It was just killing time. And to have an episode of Doctor Who where Ace is in it, and she's not even with the Doctor until the last 10 minutes, whatever it is.
That is an odd choice, yeah. I mean, I certainly sat through it thinking, yeah, but I want the Doctor and Ace. I want the Doctor and Ace. That's the dynamic that gets me interested. And particularly, I mean, I'm surprised this didn't put me off more, really, because I'm not an expert on Star Wars, okay, and the reason for that is because it's absolute rubbish. I've watched it and it's rubbish, but I can recognize how heavily influenced this has been by the whole Star Wars thing, and in particular this strand with the whole Jedi in training thing, and also elsewhere with Tanis representing the dark side of the Jedi and all that.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of interesting, but we'll come to that. I mean, I'll make the Star Wars comparison. The other thing in Star Wars is not just the Jedi, it's the Force.
Yes.
The Force is this magical power that binds us, binds the universe together, which has heretofore never existed in Doctor Who universe, and suddenly is the actual power that all the Time Lords have, and that's the real thing they're never supposed to do. Meddling in time? Yeah, right, fine, but you can't use your powers to do it. That's the part that's like, really, that is such a, it's such a fundamental mistake. But of course, the A story doesn't have any meaning if you don't have some tangible thing that she can learn to harness and control to become the next phase of human evolution or whatever it is. So, it's a really bad. It's like J.J. Abrams took over and decided he wanted to do Doctor Who, which, please, never do that, please.
the thing in my head about the Academy on Gallifrey, largely, I have to say, because the kind of sense of it comes from conversations between the Doctor and Romana, is that it's some sort of very stuffy, as you know, most Gallifreyan institutions seem to be when they're portrayed on the television. Some kind of very stuffy seat of learning with old-fashioned wooden desks and inkwells and decrepit professors and all the rest of it. And this represents something completely different to that. I mean, they've completely sexed up the whole idea of a Time Lord in training, mm-hmm. to this big mystical one-on-one, almost like being a kind of it's sort of pulling on some Eastern mysticism, yes. And the idea of being a master and student thing. It's bringing all of that.
But we did have that. I mean, clearly, everything we've learned about Time Lords, becoming a Time Lord, it is an educational process. And then, I mean, until we got to the looking into the Untempered Schism kind of nonsense later on. But it sounds like exactly like you say. They go in, they sit at desks, they have inkwells, they write with quills, they listen to professors. Thing. But the Doctor has always been different because the Doctor used to go hang out with Kampo Rampo Chi. The little old man up the hill.
Yes.
So he did get his dose of mysticism, but that was balanced against the education. And if this had been Kampo and the Doctor had sent her to his old mentor, then that would be different. But this feels like this is the process all Time Lords go through,
right.
And then get up to the Kingmaker and she gives you a silly name.
Would it be that different? I mean, you've got to think that it's got to be for something to do with the Doctor that Ace has been put in this position.
Yes.
So he would clearly have chosen someone to teach her who in some way he was sympathetic with regard to his own education. I think you've done a pretty good job of defending that aspect of the story, actually. You're right. It's much better than I thought.
Except that Casmus is kind of implying that all Time Lords go through this same process, and that's not what we got from the Doctor, is that he wasn't particularly good at the process everybody else goes through. And he's kind of poor student, and Peruso is one of his professors, and this feels like straight out of Jedi.
Yeah,
we're going to do the Jedi thing, and then of course you've got the Kingmaker up on top of the mountain that you get to. That I don't know, is she bestows the power? She the ultimate Time Lord in the end? I didn't get her either. The Time Lords are dead, she's not. So. I don't know. I didn't care for that particular thread of the story at the end. So let's talk about the Sylvester McCoy thread. I'm doing these in order of interestingness, and Sylvester McCoy's and Ace's are the least interesting parts of this story. I think, but
I'm not going to argue with you. In order of interesting, but I think it takes a big step up to the Sylvester McCoy line. thing about Sylvester McCoy's story is it's actually quite variable.
It's two stories.
Yeah, yeah. And they... Well, I don't know. I mean, do you include the whole...
Almost sort of three.
Do you include the whole Tannis thread in this? Because that's kind of where it's leading, but that's not... So is the Minister of Chance. That's almost a thread in its own.
Well, I feel like the first part of this story is Sylvester McCoy arrives at a planet that's been invaded by a bad guy, and he's starting to help.
Yeah,
and that's a standard Doctor Who story with his companion, who we've never heard of before, Antimony, and unless that's in one of the books somewhere,
I've never come across him.
He's a companion, the Doctor, and they're trying to help. And then the Minister of Chance pops up and says, "Whoa, two Time Lords killed. You better go check that out. I'll take care of things here." So end of that story for the Doctor. Doctor now goes to Earth, where two Time Lords have been killed, and he's discovering that the universe is being destroyed, because that's what they discovered. And we have vampire attacks ripping apart London. And, okay, sort of solved that. And then we go off to another planet, the planet that Tannis is the general for, to try to shut his empire down. And then that becomes a story about rescuing a baby for the prime minister because Tannis is holding him hostage. And it felt like three complete,
yes,
kind of like the Key to Time almost, where you've got this sort of three steps along this process. Yes, we're all leading to Tannis in the end. But.
Yeah. Yes. Exactly. And that's kind of where the variability comes in. In a way, it kind of gives the story the episodes some kind of identity, because if you're going to have this very strange 3 to 5 minute scenes structure, but you're also going to have episodes as well on top of it, there's got to be some beginning, middle, and end to each episode within it. And so, in a sense, it's the Doctor, as you say, arriving on the first planet in the first episode. Second episode is the vampires. Third episode, I can't even remember what it was, and then
the baby rescue
Tannis thing. So there is a bit more structure to it, but I don't think all the stories are necessarily equally engaging. What I would say is, I think Sylvester McCoy, and so I've kind of come out as being a Seventh Doctor fan, but the Seventh Doctor himself is incredibly variable. I mean, mention the fact that first season Seventh Doctor is completely different to the second and third season Seventh Doctor. Also, on the kind of audio side, McCoy has gone on to play the Doctor in many, many, many more Big Finish stories. Sometimes he, I have to say, not often, but occasionally, really does kind of phone it in, and other times he knocks it out of the park. And this is, I think, a top-notch McCoy performance, even if the stories that he's sometimes in don't make a lot of sense. So one good thing is McCoy in this.
For what little he's in it.
Yeah, there isn't enough of him, for sure, and that's partly because you've got all of these other strands going on. Also, you've got... I mean, there were things in this where I thought, this is really, really badly written.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, so you've got Antimony,
mm-hmm,
who is this utterly, utterly generic alien character.
Mm-hmm.
And then that kind of gets explained because it turns out that he is just this generic alien companion because the Doctor built him because he was feeling a bit lonely.
Yeah.
Okay. But that doesn't necessarily make Antimony... And again, it comes down to the fact that there are a lot of great actors. And this is Kevin Eldon. So he's... In a lot of British sitcoms and sketch shows of the late 90s and noughties and now, you will see him and you will recognise him if you see him. Things like Big Train and... this kind of thing. He's a brilliant comic actor. Episode 2, Antimony gets a few funny lines, but he's basically wasted.
He's not much. He's so generic. He's, you know, it's just like fill in the companion. It's like, wait, you have Ace. You have Ace, yeah, that could be the companion, and yet you've built this literally, built this other generic boring companion so that you can have two threads. It's like...
And explaining that doesn't really make... You know, it doesn't excuse the fact that you've sat through whatever it is, three episodes of him being generic and boring.
Till he's killed. Spoiler there, folks.
Yeah.
He doesn't make it through this one. So the doctor is wrong again. He can't have a companion that will last forever with him. They still die.
Yeah. Poor doctor. But I mean, the same thing happened in episode two, where you get Speedwell, who is a very... He kind of appears to be a kind of generic Cockney, Mockney copper, except that his idea of police procedure is very, very odd. You know, kind of, I'll just handcuff Antimony as a suspect, but I will just leave him on his own, handcuffed in this place, while I go off and pursue another lead or whatever.
That was pretty weird.
And various other kind of procedural anomalies, which turn out to be explained because he's not actually a policeman. Turns out to be working for the brig. But still, when you're watching it, it comes across as just being bad writing. So
do not let me forget to talk about NASA in this before we're done. anyway, we'll get to that when we talk about the brig. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, the unit story is probably part of the Doctor's story now.
All right, we can count it as that. I mean, at some point, Tanis decides to invade Earth. And the Doctor has kind of given them a tool to be prepared in advance, given it to the Brigadier's people. So, you know, there's a lot of people out there in this world who consider... And some of it's justified. I'm not going to say this is wrong. Consider that Americans are pretty arrogant people about the way they go about their business. But you can't get any more Britishly condescending than the actors they had playing the Americans at NASA. Come on, babe. What are you going to do? Let me slap your butt, please. I mean, holy cow, those were so badly, stereotypically, insultingly written. I would have hit the writer if he'd been in the room. I seriously, it was that bad. That was so insulting, I can't even believe it. I mean, make fun of George Bush if you want to, but even he wasn't as bad as they portrayed him in this episode. No, he was bad.
I mean,
he was an idiot, but I mean, they portrayed him as a guy who couldn't even... pick his nose properly, and you know he at least managed to get elected, even if it was a stolen election in the end. But he had some smarts in that man. It just didn't show much. It was like, oh, you got planned.
And it didn't show in this, so that's fair enough. But I mean, and I speak as someone who enjoys Minuet in Hell. There's probably about three of us in that club.
I didn't know there were that many.
two, maybe. And yet I did find those American portrayals extremely grating.
That was Starsky or Hutch, wasn't it? That was David Soul.
Yeah. Yeah,
I
don't
remember which one he is, but I mean, so it wasn't even a fake American. He was doing a fake American accent as an American, just like I was.
Yeah. Yeah. But the other one,
Hootenanny? Did one of those people say Hootenanny?
Yeah.
We don't even... It's like...
That's Scottish.
What? Where did that come... It's like people... NASA. For crying out loud, it's NASA. Those are our smart people. Be different if it were...
It stuck out.
Yeah. It was kind of insult. And then the British space shuttles. Followed up with a fleet of space shuttles with big British flags on them. It's like, well, that's a little...
That was the Valiant.
You just smacked down NASA, something fierce.
The Last of the Time Lords.
And then you stole our space shuttles too.
Well, we stole some pictures of them. Overreact. It was the Valiant. The whole idea of unit in orbit defending the Earth and all this stuff. It was the only thing is. Obviously, Last of the Sound of Drums, is it?
Oh yeah, yeah.
That's just, you have the American president in that one being vaporized.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm not saying.
Whereas I would much rather have seen George Bush vaporized, to be honest.
I thought that probably was supposed to be George Bush too. I mean, obviously, it wasn't like
not,
Nixon
not
was, supposed
this one was supposed to be
mission,
George.
But yeah, this one was definitely. I mean, that was Culshaw, wasn't it? Doing his George yes. Bush imitation. Yeah,
yeah.
So.
He should have done the Tony Blair as well, because the guy they had doing it was terrible. But
yeah, he does a pretty good Tony Blair too. Yeah, so although nobody would believe Tony Blair had a plan, but yeah, it was just yes, in Sound of Drums and Last Day vaporized. And I think it's interesting that the American president's portrayed as a pompous ass in that, and fair enough. You kind of have to be a pompous ass to work your way up there, but he stayed dead. I think that was definitely something that Russell T. Davies was telling us, because they undo everything to the moment after the president is killed, which that's kind of interesting choice there. It's fine with me, because it's just a fictional character anyway, and I'm not really a defender of the American president either, but it's just... It just was like, well, you know, I think maybe you're letting a little wish fulfillment show up there on the screen. But this was bad. Anyway, the brig saves the day. Unit troops, for the first time ever, managed to blow up an invading fleet of aliens, I think, by themselves, without the doctor. I mean, he gave them advance warning, but...
Well.
And so, I mean, that's kind of... The reason I didn't go into that, because then there's the last little bit of the story... The final face off, which I like to save for the end. But
yeah.
Brigadier didn't have many lines.
No, sadly.
But it was
at least he was in it.
It was in it.
That was one of the best bits.
And although what was his incredibly awful line? You have the misfortune to be talking to the Brigadier. Remember that? He actually referred to himself as the Brigadier. Tannis says, you have the fortune of addressing Tannis Loader thing, and Brigadier says, well, you have the misfortune of addressing Brigadier.
Yeah.
Like,
yes. Yeah.
Wouldn't you have said Brigadier Alistair Gordon Lethbridge Stewart or something like that? But,
yeah.
Like, wow, that was slack. Anyway. Okay, let's talk about the Minister of Chance.
Yeah.
Stephen Fry's turn as a Time Lord. To me, this is kind of the interesting story. You were talking about how Tannis was the Darth Vader. Actually, no. The Minister of Chance is. The Star Wars lesson of Darth Vader is that if you use your powers, even if it's for good, in an emotional state, you are lost down a path of... And I know this is making Star Wars sound deeper than it is, but that is the story trail there, and that's how...
Okay,
That's how the Emperor led Anakin Skywalker to become Darth Vader, by putting him in situations where his emotions ruled him and he used his powers when he should not have done so. And that's exactly what Tannis is doing to the Minister of Chance. He is getting him emotionally involved with these people that he's trying to help until it reaches the point where, you know, it's just a little thing. I healed your broken wrist, or, oh, I stopped the bleeding loss, or I wiped out the alien fleet with a single thought and destroyed them all because I'm in a rage.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he is...
Yeah, that completely... The Star Wars influence on that passed me by, because though I watched them, I found it difficult to... pay attention.
Fair enough.
But
there's a lot of
bands. But actually, in this, I did find the whole Minister storyline to be very engaging, and I really enjoyed Stephen Fry's performance in this. I mean, lot of the
it's tragic.
Kind of people they got, I thought, were wasted, but Stephen Fry was excellent, and he was given something to do. So we had a proper bit of story here, and had it been just the Minister of Chance story, I would have rated it much higher than I did.
Yeah, he definitely had the opportunity. He was a tragic figure in this. You know, through actions that I think we can all agree on, probably, that if you were in that situation, of course, you haven't had that training of Time Lords learning about being outside the block of time and all, but which Ace is getting. But I can understand that if you had those powers, how could it hurt to heal her wrist or to save a life? When you reach the point where you slaughter them all. And I mean, that is right out of, that's right out of a scene in Star Wars, one of the Star Wars films, where the kid's, Anakin's mom is killed, and in a rage, he goes and just wipes out the killers. It's just right out of one of those, one of the even worse batch of the first three films.
I haven't even tried to watch it.
Don't. Oh my gosh. I mean, no, don't. No, no, no.
But even before we get to the kind of using the Force in this, the minister has almost a more doctorish role than the doctor, because he wanders into to the enemy and kind of says hello. I'm the minister, and this is my companion. He goes and gets himself captured deliberately, in the way that the doctor always goes and gets himself captured, and then, you know, does the whole take me to your leader thing, and has some scheme running about how this is going to be, how this is going to be to the advantage of the rebels, or to bring peace and sort everything out, in much the way the doctor does. And then something goes wrong and it's tragic, and he wants to help, in much the way the doctor does. So at least up to that point, it's very, very much like the role the doctor would normally play, while McCoy is kind of prattling about being a police inspector's psychic in a vampire.
In a rather gruesome vampire thing.
Yeah. So it's another reason why I kind of felt that the minister storyline was really both the engaging one, and also really the Doctor Who one.
I don't disagree. It's the better piece of the story, and I guess it would be difficult to tell it with the Doctor, because the Doctor can't, well, you'd think the Doctor can't be the tragic figure that has to be put down at the end.
Yeah.
You know, that's what you can do in a movie that you can't do in a continuing TV series. And it's a counterpoint to show us, well, we know what the Doctor is like. Here's a guy that's just like the Doctor, and yet he crosses the line. And this is why the line is so dangerous. So therefore, this is why in the Ace storyline, they're trying to convey how dangerous the line is. And by the time I got to the end of it, the three threads were tied up a little better than I thought they ever could possibly be. I still didn't really like them, except for the Minister of Chance storyline.
I thought they did kind of mesh. The pacing was off, but the stories did come together, so that by episode five, which was by far the best episode, it did feel like it was actually building to something, and there was some kind of tension and a bit of momentum to the whole thing.
It's just that the pacing was so off to me. I really was kind of surprised that they came together. I could have easily believed that Ace never met the Doctor in this episode whatsoever. it was just so odd that, you know, how we picked her up in the middle of nothing, obviously not being the Doctor's companion, being a prisoner somewhere. You know, the Doctor's moved on. I could totally see them never meeting. Her coming into the story after the Doctor is gone at the end and saving the day. I mean, I could have seen that.
What we want is for them to be reunited. I mean, this is 12 years after the previous Doctor and Ace story had aired, you know, counting only TV. And obviously, during the 12 years when they've been off air, time has passed for them as well. And what we want when the story starts is we want to see them come together. And clearly that is what gives this, or is what is at least intended. Had it been paced better, I think it would have worked. It's intended to give the story some of the tension. And you can't kind of bring them together without actually dissipating that. So they have to hold out till episode five in that. But I do take your point that when it happens, it's far too brief. Then there needs to be more more proper Ace and the Doctor in it.
Ah, so I mean, yeah, that part. Again, just the whole thing is just like, well, it's an interesting bit of experimental writing, but it kind of a miss. So let's talk about a little bit about Tanis. Eventually, we learn Tanis has been running these armies, and he's been taking over planets with this vast military force. And it turns out he's a Time Lord, and he has been killing the other Time Lords. And every time he kills them, he basically taunts them. Well, you have the power to destroy me, but you won't, will you? So I'm going to shoot you. And then he shoots them, and they die. Which is, you know, keeping with this whole Time Lords have this incredible power, but you're not going to use it, and so therefore I'm going to get you. And the universe is falling apart, basically. Death is coming to time, and this is sort of what the Doctor is investigating. And at first he suspects it's Tanis, but it's pointed out that Tanis has been scrupulously not breaking the rules. He's just been using conventional techniques in much the same way the Doctor is always using conventional techniques. So he is almost he's like the anti-Doctor in this story. He doesn't break the rules, but he, not the big rule anyway, but he has put his mind towards what we would call evil, and the Doctor has put his mind towards... He's almost more like the Master should be than the Master is, in many... Which is... Why is the Master not in this?
What? Well, I think it's not quite the Master's role, because obviously, although he's doing that... I mean, it's certainly not a million miles away. They're both after power.
Power. And he's doing a good job of it.
But Tanis...
Better than the Master.
Tanis also has this thing of he's trying to bait the Time Lords while he's doing it, isn't he?
And he's manipulating the Doctor and the Minister to come to loggerheads and destroy each other. And he's done a good job. Of all the things in this story, Tanis is actually the most credible villain, Time Lord villain the Doctor has had in a long time. Not only is he successful at taking over planets and building his own power base and doing his stuff, but he also has a plan that actually catches the Doctor out and would have defeated him if the Doctor hadn't been willing to die himself.
Yeah, no, I mean, thinking back through the kind of Time Lords the Doctor has faced, he is actually a pretty good adversary. And not to mention the fact, of course, that he's played by John Sessions, who's full-on scenery chewing in this. So,
is that what John Sessions actually looks like? I mean, are these artwork... Because no. I say, like, Stephen Fry obviously looks like Stephen Fry. So I didn't know if the other actors were
supposed
to look like...
Sophie Aldred doesn't look like Ace in this.
Well...
I don't think that Sessions... I mean, I'm more used to his voice than his appearance. I'm trying to think back to, God, whose line is it anyway, or whatever I would have seen him on. But I certainly don't think he looks like Tanis. And I don't think that Kevin Eldon looks much like Antimony. Trying to think of who else there was. I mean, Anthony Head had a tiny part in this, didn't he? He didn't.
I saw the name, but I didn't figure out where he was.
Oh, he was... I think it was near the start of episode... two or end of episode. It was early on, really brief appearance. He's very recognizable, his voice, and thankfully, of course, he comes back to Doctor Who in a better part later on, because again, that's a terrible waste, and he's done several Big Finish stories, but I'm not sure all of the drawings are quite direct representations of the actors.
I couldn't. The only ones that I could recognize.
Jacqueline
obviously,
Pierce is in this?
Yes, I heard Jacqueline Pierce's voice. I did hear her. I go, oh, Servalan! That voice is very, very recognizable to me. There was no doubt in my mind there. That was very early on, too. Because I think she died in the first battle. I thought, well, that's kind of weird.
Well,
Big Finish can't even get her in for the Blake 7 audios because she lives in South Africa or something. But
really? Oh, she's done a couple of Doctor Who's.
Has she? Well, they haven't gotten her in yet. They said they haven't been able to because of where she lives in South Africa. So, which is,
I'm sure they will.
A shame, really, because it's got to happen anyway.
They get Mark Strickson in from New Zealand or whatever. So I'm sure they'll persuade her
somehow. Yeah, well, I hope so.
Send her photographs of the lunch that they serve.
I've heard that's very good. Yes, everybody says the lunches are wonderful. Big Finish, where the lunches are wonderful. That's what they should, instead of "we love telling stories."
Yeah. There's got to be some reason why they get such great casts. But I don't know how they managed to get these amazing casts. But then when Dan Friedman did the Minister of Chance podcast, again, it's got an incredible array of actors doing that. You know, people like Jenny Agutu and so forth. So and incidentally, I think those podcasts are very good. They obviously focus on the Minister of Chance as the main character, so they don't suffer from the structural and pacing problems that this does. So it's not that there isn't the ability and the capacity there to produce a good story out of this. I think it is just somewhat hobbled by technical problems on the one hand and not really being Doctor Who on the other hand. Okay.
So let's get down to the brass, the end of the line then. So the Minister of Chance, having wiped out the entire invading fleet using his evil Time Lord powers that are now consuming him and destroying the universe, because he's the one that's actually destroying the universe inadvertently with this powers that Tannis has been manipulating him to do, forcing the Doctor to meet him and also use his forbidden Time Lord powers to first revoke his TARDIS, which is just a strange bit of dialogue. "Your TARDIS revoked!" And with the animation, you're like, what is that? Did he just make it? I don't know what happened there. And then I think he destroys the Minister of Chance. They had no choice. He either makes him go away or do whatever it is. And I think we're kind of given the impression that he and the Minister destroy each other, but in fact they don't, because the Doctor shows up at Stonehenge. A little cliche, but okay, that's where the aliens decide to invade the Earth. And once again, we have... he gets hold of Ace. This is the reunion. Well, pretty close to the reunion. He gets hold of Ace. He's going to kill Ace. This is kind of what he was doing with Antimony early. Or Antimony, if you want to look at it. Earlier, he was threatening to kill him if the Doctor didn't use his powers. It's the exact same thing he was doing to the other Time Lords. "You won't kill me. You're going to die. You could use your power. You'll kill me, but you won't." And the Doctor uses his power and destroys them both. Himself and Tannis. Story over. And then Ace goes back to see the Kingmaker again and doesn't actually become a Time Lord, but I guess the offer is open, I think. Not sure what the ending was supposed to mean exactly.
Well, she's obviously got the abilities or whatever. I mean,
Does she?
She's had the teaching. Whether she has the supernatural abilities, because they have to be conferred, presumably, I would take it not. But on the other hand, she is this force because of who she is and the fact that she's had this kind of...
And she has a TARDIS.
Self-realization, yeah. So, yeah, there's definitely something about her kind of being this... proto-doctor type of force within time now.
Oh, I forgot to mention she goes through the Kobayashi Maru too. So I know your Star Trek is as limited as your Star Wars. The Kobayashi Maru is something introduced in the Star Trek movies.
I should just say I do like Star Trek. I am ignorant of it, as you point out, but
later on in the series they introduce it. This Starfleet Academy test, the Kobayashi Maru test, in which all command graduates are put on a starship simulator and they're put into a situation where they are going to die. They don't know that going in, but there is absolutely no way to get out. You're going to die. And the lesson learned is how to face death and how to fail at what you're doing and the consequences of failing. And long story short, only one Starfleet guy ever beat it, and that's James Kirk. And that's strictly because he cheated. And he broke into the computers and reprogrammed it. He cheated it. That's kind of the character development thing they're going with Kirk, is about how he cheats death. That's the theme of that movie. But this is exactly the same thing. We give Ace the power. We send her to this planet. Here, don't use your powers to save things. And then everything goes to hell in a handbasket, and she fails. And it's a lesson to teach, I guess, humility or the disasters that could go wrong. It really is sort of a hodgepodge of stuff they've stolen from other shows. But she's gone through all that. She's learned the lesson from that. She's got a TARDIS. But I just kind of get at the end, the Kingmaker is kind of like making the offer, but she hasn't accepted. So here's my question. Would you, based on this, if next week they had a series of Ace adventures following this one, would that, and you like Ace as a companion, would that draw you in?
Probably not, based on this. I mean, I might check out something that was a series about Ace because it was a series about Ace, for example.
She seems like a sidekick to me. But
well, I don't know. There's a new kind of version of Big Finish's Gallifrey spin-off that now features Ace as a character in it. That's renewed my interest in listening to the series, because I want to get to the bit with Ace in it. So it would appeal to me, even for something where I hadn't been interested in it enough necessarily to kind of steam through it previously. But based on what I've seen in this, I wouldn't have much hope in it in a Death Comes to Time Ace spin-off being much good. Having said that, the Minister of Chance spin-off turns out to be a lot better than I would expect based on looking at Death Comes to Time. Now, I know I've said I liked the Minister of Chance storyline in this, so maybe that's why I would be...
But this is just it's completely different people, right? They just picked it up and said, "Woo, Minister of Chance, like that character, I think he'll do something different with it."
Nope. It's Dan Friedman again. So the director of this went on to write and produce the series of podcasts, and is the kind of mover behind getting the
did he
the,
write
the film
this
together?
I noticed
don't
the name
know.
Was like
he's
a,
not
obviously a
credited
fake
at
name.
It, but I think it's thought that he did. The guy who the interesting thing about this, because you know there were as I've said, I kind of criticised the writing at points in this. The script editor on it is Nev Fountain, who is a
Perry's
terrific writer.
He's
also
Bryan's
married
husband,
to Nicola
right?
Bryan. Yeah. But he has written a number of Big Finish Doctor Who audios. He writes Private Eye stuff, and he wrote Dead Ringers stuff. So he's done a lot of radio comedy. But some of his Doctor Who stories for Big Finish, which although they have a lot of comic stuff in, are really good dramatic stories as well. So I would expect great things from something that was script edited by Nev Fountain, possibly a bit greater than we got.
Well, I would hope a lot greater than we got.
Because his other stuff has been so fantastic, and the guy who kind of produced this for the web, James Goss, edited the recent New Adventures of Bernice Summerfield Doctor Who box set, which is an amazingly well structured, again, post Ace has been to the Academy on Gallifrey post that story, but it's an amazingly well structured collection of stories which are each completely different and yet which form part of a central coherent storyline. I think James Goss is a brilliant writer, so something with him as a mastermind behind it should be better than this is. I mean, I say this bearing in mind that they have obviously 10 to 15 years further experience since then. But
could
but
have something to
big
do
names.
With it. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So let me ask. Let me throw up the conspiracy angle before we sign off here. Obviously, the BBC notoriously has always been wanting to destroy Doctor Who for many, many years. We all know that, because it's just everybody in the conspiracy believes that. Was this them trying to finish the damn thing? Was this like, you know,
we
canceled Doctor Who, but we didn't kill him off yet. So let's bring him back for one last story, kill him off, get this thing off so people will stop bugging us. Is that... What, was it just...
Because the BBC isn't one homogenous organisation. It's not like...
Somebody must have final oversee of the property, though. Surely they don't.
No, because that's precisely the reason why you don't have a kind of neat standard continuity running through it, or anyone kind of saying things which are established in the spin-off continuity are official or unofficial, because there is no one single gatekeeper.
I thought that I had heard on repeated occasions that although... And some during the wilderness years, but particularly later on and towards the less wildernessy years, the BBC is pretty strict about not letting them do certain things that contradict their rules. They'll ignore everything that they do in the books, basically, for the most part, but the books aren't allowed to ignore the show. I thought that's what I had...
There's a difference between Doctor Who when there is a producer of the show and the Wilderness Years. So it doesn't really apply to the so-called classic era, the kind of up to 1989 stuff, because there wasn't so much spin-off stuff then. I mean, okay, there were the Target novelizations and what have you, but they were. The stories were established because they were straight take it from what was on TV. But when you didn't have a production office, there wasn't one central point where the scripts would always be vetted. So now anything that gets produced that's an official BBC licensed product gets okayed by the BBC production office in Cardiff. So there is some kind of central control. But even then, it's not one person overseeing it, because it's a series of people overseeing it, the property, you know, running through. And what Russell T. Davis will okay, Stephen Moffat might not, or vice versa. So it's still not one person, and that's what you see in the classic era, where you get different bits of continuity picked up on or contradicted under the 10 years of different producers of the show. And I think what happens during the Wilderness Years is bits of the BBC, the BBC as a corporation, own Doctor Who. There are initiatives to, hey, let's make a co-production with Fox and do a kind of new series or whatever. So that's an initiative. That's an initiative, in fairness, which I don't think is made by an organisation that's trying to kill the thing off. But also you've got the bit of the BBC that makes Children in Need... or Comic Relief or whatever it was, approaches Nathan Turner and says, can we do this 30th anniversary hoo-ha crossover with EastEnders? There's a bit with Radio 2 where they reach out to Barry Letts and say, can we get John Pertwee back to make some new Third Doctor stories? And then what you've got going on here is the kind of bit of the BBC, BBC I, as it was called in those days, that is all about the kind of then nascent web arm of the BBC, because it again easy to forget how that wasn't a kind of all-powerful big and important property as it was now. Those people kind of find a small budget of money, say, oh, Doctor Who, no one's doing anything with that, let's do something. And then it's the fringes of the BBC, and no one is kind of telling them we can or can't do that with Doctor Who, because no one is competing for Doctor Who. No one else is using it at the time.
Well, and even, if they'd been trying, then, they would. They did. They made a dab good effort at trying to kill it.
I don't think they were trying to kill it. They were trying to. They were trying to revive it. But we will see over the next
10-ish
four stories, I think, that are all made by BBC I in the period prior to the show coming back. So early 21st century. They are all in their way completely different from one another. So even though it's the same kind of branch of the BBC making them, what they produce is this set of disparate and contradictory stories.
So what is the next?
The next one is Real Time.
Real Time. Which is and who is the doctor?
Sixth Doctor story.
Okay.
From pretty soon after this one was made, but by produced by different people, even though it's drawn by the same person. And I think this is a reason for doing the animation in this order, because clearly in 2001 the animation isn't great. I quite like the drawings, I have to say, but the animation is poor. So let's get that out of the way, so that, you know, by the time we get round to the Cosgrove Hall stuff and the like, we can really start to enjoy it.
Well, Simon, thank you for joining me.
It's been a pleasure, as always.
And listeners, we hope you'll join us when we get back for our next Doctor Who. Well, we hope you'll join us before we get back for our next Doctor Who episode. But when we get back for our next Doctor Who episode, I hope you will join us for Real Time. Is that, by the way, is that Real Time, R-E-A-L, or R-E-E-L time?
R-E-A-L.
Okay. Okay. Real Time. The real thing. The real deal time. All right. I guess I should say cheerio at this point.
Wait, say it again.
Good night.
Oh, that was not at all abrupt.
Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us, leave us a review on iTunes. Or stop by and visit at our website, fusionpatrol.com. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Search for Fusion Patrol. Or just drop us a note at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolfe.